Welcome to a new episode of Becoming a Post-Growth Planner, Obstacles and Challenges to Changing Roles and Practices. My name is Christian Lamker, assistant professor at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And for this episode, I have the honor to welcome Sophie Sturrup from Jiangtong Liverpool University in China. You will correct my spelling and pronunciation, I guess. You join us from Liverpool today, sharing global, local experiences. We will move geographically a bit further, but nevertheless also a bit further into ourselves. And I'm much looking forward to that.
As you say, my name is Sophie Sturrup. I work for Xi'an Jiaotong Liverpool University in China, which is in Suzhou. I've been there for about 10 years. I'm a senior associate professor. I've held plenty of positions at that university, which I don't currently hold at the moment. So at the moment, I am a free agent able to think about research without a lot of extra academic titles attached to my name, which is rather nice, having been, you know, in various positions like program directoring and so on. And before I was at XJTLU, I was working for a short time at Melbourne University. I did my PhD at Melbourne University and my master's at Oxford University.
We met last year in July for the first time at the ESOP Annual Congress 2024, ESOP Association of European Schools of Planning in Paris, where you presented in the post-growth track about beyond individualism, what's there and how do we get to it. It was quite an engaging session. Also, Federico Savini, Isabella Mironovitz, other guests in this podcast have been part of this session. And you talked about other ways of being, community, even indigenous knowledge, starting from a crisis of individualism. Can you maybe explain to us what you understand as the crisis of individualism?
It starts with a question about what's the future that a sustainable future would actually look like? And what kind of humans would populate a world in which was actually sustainable? So, and that led me to start thinking about the sustainable development goals, which when I first started dealing with them, I interacted with as a set of projects to produce outcomes. And I observed that increasingly, particularly around the latest movements within the sustainable development discussion at the United Nations around protection of large sections of the planet as wilderness, that increasingly at the UN and in various places, you see this dialogue or shift of dialogue of the sustainable development goals to something more akin to a kind of visioning of a future. And that future isn't one in which we've met the sustainable goals, but is more about that it is a world in which it isn't necessary to have goals around those things anymore, because we're no longer perpetuating a structure in which produces those issues. And I can start to see that that's why people are increasingly talking about justice as a key element of sustainable development. But this led me to start thinking about, okay, these people that are living in this world, you know, what would have to shift, or who would we be being that would generate that world? Because in my reality, if you like, my understanding of the world, our being is in a dance with the world that occurs for us, and it creates the world that occurs for us. So it's like a back and forth thing, right? So if you look at the most powerful places in which something gets generated, it gets generated when it's in alignment with who we're being. So if we are, for example, that we cannot catch. Right? It becomes our reality. It's we constitute it that way. And, you know, there's lots of experiments, social science experiments and psychology experiments, which demonstrate that if you take people out of that reality, that conversation or worldview of themselves, for example, you throw a ball at them and you say, tell me which way the ball is spinning. they will catch the ball because they're not in the conversation. They're not in the reality that says, I can't catch. They're in the reality about watching the ball spin, and they just catch the ball because it's a lot easier, right? So this is how the world is constituted by the being we have. So then who would we need to be in order to have a sustainable development? And that leads me that back to, so I started looking at what's in the way. And it seems to me that individualism, the notion that we're separate from everything else, that we're, and that that separation is a justifiable reason for doing things that harm sustainability in all its forms, is really the thing that would have to shift. Now, that's not everything in individualism, but there are certain parts of individualism that's going to have to change, and the primary one, I think, is this narcissism thing.
Yeah, before our conversation today, we are in January 2025. I looked back into some notes that I took in July last year, and I noted down a statement that's made by you. In fact, you are multiple beings already. Addressing the audience, what does that mean? We are multiple beings already, each of us.
Well, the really simple way of explaining the concept of being, we tend to think about, we're told that we are something, right? But that is quite clearly not true. If you take the exercise, if you close your eyes and you imagine yourself, and I would invite the people listening to try this, if you close your eyes and you imagine yourself sitting at the dinner table with your parents, you will almost certainly be able to point to that that person sitting there is not the one sitting here listening to this podcast. In fundamental ways, they're a completely different human being. And that's what I mean by being. And we're all carrying around these multiple beings with us all the time. You know, we have being a parent, we have being a student, we have being a teacher, we have being a child, we have being a man, being a woman, being somewhere in between those two things, right? Whatever beings we carry around, we carry them in us, and they fundamentally, the world we see when we're sitting in that skin bag, if we like, the being we're present to gives us a different world. So you can say things when you're being a professor in a conference that you would never be able to say to your parents, right? Not from the being that is the kid. Now, you can bring the being that's the professor that speaks at conferences to the dinner table, but he's not typically the one that's there. We have all these different beings. We're never really one thing.
In your work that you also presented for the conference, you delved into some of alternatives that you explored also to perceive our way of being as such. How do they also help shed us light on the way of being and our potential also for radical transformations?
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of this individualist thing, I've become really interested in this. The discussions, there's a set of discussions by Janka Porter around the role of narcissism or the defence against narcissism that Aboriginal Australian peoples have built within their culture. And I started to really look at that because I think, you know, there's a question about, okay, there are really good things about being an individual, you know, creativeness, entrepreneurialism, these things come from this kind of individuating oneself, of understanding that you might have a purpose which is different than the people around you, or that you have something to contribute as a person. And those ideas are important, but when those ideas start to become me ahead of everyone else, me ahead of or me, me and mine, like possessive, that's the kind of individualism that needs to be fought against. And in Aboriginal thinking, there are a number of interesting ideas. One of them is that you should not associate yourself with lots of people who are like you, because when you get together with all sorts of like-minded people who think like you do and see the world the way you do and so on, it reinforces this notion that you're right and your way is the only way. And you forget that there are multiple ways of being and multiple interpretations and multiple, in fact, worlds that are all existing together. And when you do that, you lose access to moderating your behavior in ways that are appropriate to allow for the continuation of those other worlds, including, for example, environmental protection.
Thanks for taking us into Aboriginal ideas and also thoughts to position ourselves in the world and also to be exposed to different ideas or expose ourselves maybe. What you say are good ways to do that also in our world, not to get lost in being together with like-minded people and, you know, finding positive support for the ideas that we have in people that share the idea nevertheless.
Yeah, well, I think I was actually saying something about this to somebody earlier today. We were talking about science and how important it is to, you know, for a scientific discussion to remind itself that any conversation you're having is happening in language, and language requires the separation of the object and the subject. You can't talk about anything when you can't separate the subject and the object, because that's the nature of language. But the world we live in, you know, the experience of drinking coffee is not like that. The world that is actually out there, separate from our conversation, the world that we're actually living in, is whole. And so one thing I was observing is this discussion about going back to everyday people or normal people, academics going back to normal people, you know, something that has been a tradition since Aristotle, to go back to the experience of people who are doing things in the world and investigate what that is. It reminds us that this world we're inventing in our heads, in our conversations, in our language, is not the world, right? So that's one place that I think is critical. We remember why it's important that academics get out of their heads and go and be in the world that people actually live in. It's not simply about being reminded that there are these other problems out there that we then grab hold of and fix. It's about being reminded that the world that people live in is the whole and isn't separated into these neat little compartmentalized bits that we can then figure out how to sort out. And it's not that doing that would give us an answer to what to do, but it's critical that it reminds us we don't know what we're doing, that what we're doing is some little tiny bit, and we always have to be aware of how it pushes against all the other little bits in the whole of how things actually work.
Yeah, for me, this also explains the issue of, on the one side, we want to push a lot. On the other side, we are only a tiny part in that and have all these connections. So a small scale technological fix, let's say, is not the solution for the large scale challenges ahead. And especially when we also talk about growth and post-growth.
Yeah, but then also, I mean, it's also true to say that there isn't anything going on other than the local. Right. I mean, this large scale thing isn't anywhere other than here. You know, I remember 20 years ago, I used to say to people, I was very interested at that time in the question of hunger on the planet. And I remember saying to people, you know, you are affected by the fact that there are children starving. You are affected by the fact that there are wars going on, even if you don't think about it. You are affected by it because we're attached to everything and it is there sitting in the background. You just ignore it. And part of what separates us from the world we live in is that more and more and more you build this kind of structure of who you are as separated from the world. And maybe that's also part of the problem of individualization, that you build this structure of I'm this person that's separate from everything else. What I do doesn't matter. But of course it matters. Where else is anything happening? You know, I mean, okay, a volcano blows up. Maybe we didn't have anything to do with that, right? But even the volcano is tiny in comparison to the planet or the universe.
Absolutely. I understand this also a bit as the largest challenge maybe for us to overcome between not finding ways to individualize and separate ourselves and our thoughts by spatial scales, by individual, but by looking at the connections, togetherness, community, whatever term you use for that. I think there's many discussions trying to overcome issues concerned with individualization. Looking back at the notes that I took from last year, I also had another note in my notebook on growth as reinforcing a duty of non-care and the duty of narcissism. I think you mentioned a bit of that already a couple of minutes ago. Can you explain that, what this really means for you and also for us and all the listeners here?
Well, I mean, I think this question of a duty of care is the way out, right? You were just talking about community. You know, one of the realizations I had when we were doing, when we had COVID, was, you know, the call to community by itself is no longer going to hold water. You know, you could see it very clearly in Australia. We had this discussion in Australia at the time about, okay, everybody has to stay home to protect the old people, particularly the Aboriginal elder people, and make sure that the old people are safe, right? And that, you know, I have a duty of care to the community, blah, blah, blah idea, that lasted for about 4 weeks. And after that, people began to say, but what about me? And legitimately so, probably, right? I mean, but the question becomes, okay, how do you then start to say to people, okay, you need to moderate your behavior in some way to take care of everything, right? And I think the pathway to that is through being responsible. Being responsible isn't about, it's not about saying, I did something and therefore I have to fix it, right? Being responsible is about allowing yourself to keep looking for what's my role here? What did I do here? So, for example, I can be responsible for the perpetration of, you know, violence and colonial dispossession of Aboriginal people in Australia, even though I was born in Denmark and did not come to the country until 1972. So, you know, I am responsible for that, not as a I did something in 1788 or even now, but I am responsible. Like, I take that on because it gives me some kind of way of being in the world that is a duty of care to others. And that's where I think the way out of this individualism trap is perhaps somewhere, you know, that again, reminding ourselves that we are connected. We have that duty of care. That's something that Heidegger talked about in a being, right? That if we live in a society, it's not about caving. It's not about me taking my individualism and subjugating it to the collective. It's about me taking my individualism and using that to support the collective, because the collective is me. I'm not separate from that. Just in saying that right now, I've seen something about 20 years ago, we had a conversation. I was working with the public record office in Victoria, and we went and talked to some Koori people about Koori Aboriginal people about how things were for them because they were dealing with the children being taken away from their families, and we were trying to support that. And this person was saying, when I'm in white man world, I cannot be a black man. And when I come back, once I've been in white man world, it gets very hard for me to come back to black man world. And we talked a little bit more about that, and he was saying that in his Aboriginal community, he is the group. It's not like he's an individual that belongs to the group. He is the group. And I think that's probably actually what I mean by a duty of care, that you are the group. You are the society you live in. You are not separate from it, ever, really. It's a fantasy we create that justifies certain behaviours.
Yeah, that's quite a fundamental shift in identifying, conceptualizing who we are, what we are, and also how we relate to others, certainly. Well, you had some pointers already two decades back, and you moved to Australia, and now we talk to you in Liverpool. But we met at a conference last year around talking about post-growth, the first ASOP conference thinking about post-growth in a more structural way with the whole track on that. For many people there, post-growth was a new and unfamiliar body of thought. You also moved into this post-growth track with a lot of background in different academic works around transport project governance, public-private partnerships. Maybe you can take us just very briefly into some of your work before, how that has led you then to engage with the crisis of individualism and also towards thinking this is related indeed to post-growth.
Yeah, well, I mean, I probably started with this being thing. I came into academia late in life, after I had spent a lot of time working in government, and in government I worked on the electricity privatizations in Victoria, which gave me an exposure to this kind of public-private partnership thing. And that really was where I came into transport. So I got interested in public-private partnerships because, it didn't make any sense to me. How can you take two, worldviews that have such totally different objectives and try and put them together and think that's going to work? Like, look, what kind of crazy person would do that? And I was working in the electricity reform industry, and I found myself having these very peculiar conversations with people who were saying to me, well, of course, these electricity companies are going to take care of the people who can't afford electricity by lowering the prices, because they're a company and they want to sell their product and they don't want big chunks of people who they can't sell their product to. And I was like, really? Because I'm thinking from a government perspective, and I'm like, businesses don't behave like that, right? I mean, you have to have regulation to make them take care of people who can't afford things. So, this whole other way of thinking. It was like, what? So I got very interested in that. And when I went to Oxford and did my master's, I was at the heartland of the original space of public-private partnerships. So I was like, oh, here's this opportunity. So I was looking into, where does this come from? I was using a Foucauldian kind of governmentality approach. And I started to see that governmentality is really my code for this being business. So, and even Heidegger's work on being is, in my thesis, my PhD thesis, I merged those two things together and had a lot of conversations with a philosopher who was an expert in Foucault, who concluded that it was completely reasonable to ram those two together, even though people don't usually do so. And so the mega projects, which got me into transport, was always about this being business. It was always about, what does the structure of a mega project do to you? And what if we understood that at the level of who people become, what does that then explain to us about what goes wrong with mega projects? So you know, my thesis is the code for name for my thesis is the Madness Mega Projects. And it is about this, you know, understanding how the structure of the mega project, the way power is configured within the mega project, the way people's roles are, what their job is, how they define all that, makes it nearly impossible to have a rational discussion about should we do this. And therefore, once they've gone, they've got their own life, and that's why they look a bit crazy to people who are outside them. You know, and why people were like, why didn't they just stop doing it halfway through? And, you know, it's like, well, actually, you can see why they didn't. Very obviously, when you put yourself in their position, it's completely clear. So that context then has led to more recent discussion about or thinking about networks and how networked public transport can be actually implemented, and again looking from this point of view of who are people being around transport and how can you make a transformation of that kind of size to really create a networked system, in a system which isn't networked. So those kind of conversations is really this pathway of traveling, but it's always about this being business.
Yeah, looking then into the future, jumping a bit into what might come or what might we help to bring about. What is your hope for the coming time? How could we, or maybe not in particular spatial planning, find a new way of being part of the endeavor to transform what it is to be human? I took that term from your ESOP abstract last year.
I think as planners, I mean, one thing is, You can put your money where your mouth is, you know, like, so for example, I opened my cupboard the other day and degrowth was there in the cupboard. You know, I looked at my cupboard and I thought, okay, this is interesting. Over the last 5-6 years, I have reduced the number of things in my cupboard. And I'm talking about my clothes closet, right? So I opened my clothes closet and I look and it's like everything in my clothes closet is wool or silk, or cotton. It's the kind of things that are going to last for really long periods of time. You know, there are socks in my cupboard which are more than 10 years old, and I darn them. So I repair. Some of them have got layers of darning to make the holes go away, kind of thing. And I have a jumper. A woolen jumper in my closet, which my mother knitted for herself in 1968, and so I sort of went, oh look, this actually tells me something about what degrowth might look like, right? And that actually gives me access to really thinking about, okay, what would it mean to live in a world in which, you know, you had all these things that didn't fall apart and didn't decay, and that you then had to spend a lot of time looking after, you know, like these things have to be washed by hand and they have to be, if you want them to last, right? So, you know, it's like then I would need a lot more time. So I've really started to look at, okay, well, what should I be doing as a job? Do I need to be earning the amount of money that I'm earning, because I'm never going to have to buy any more clothes? And practically, if I look at my house, it's like I really don't need to buy anything else. So, you know, what am I earning all this money for? Apart from this kind of crazy fear about, you know, some future in which I might need all this money, you know, it's kind of started me off on really. So I think that's one place you can look, is what are you doing? And then you can start to see what could everybody else be doing. And I think we have to put our money where our mouth is. We have to look for how do we have any authority and authenticity to speak about these matters. And like yourself, I've listened to some of the podcasts and I can hear in what you're talking about, how you live your life, that you know, you've taken that on. And I'm sure there are many other people listening to this podcast who have done that, and that gives you the authority to say something. But yeah, so that's one place, mm-hmm. of future. And the other, I think, is in this, the one thing planners do is they do spend their time talking about the world people actually live in, and they spend their time talking to a lot of other people about the worlds that they live in, and that participatory planning has the opportunity to do some work in this space of not trying to solve problems, but instead trying to generate discussion, generate access to the varied worlds in which we live in, and thereby make room.
Yeah, that's already almost a wonderful final statement and also positive call for planners, but also for others listening to the podcast to reflect, to think, but also to take small scale individual action in a collective together towards a longer term future. And as usual, towards the very end of the podcast, I would now ask you to finish the sentence with a short kind of definition post-growth planning is.
Well, it's not a definition, but my response to that is post-growth planning is inevitable. Growth is gone. It's done. It really is done. We will either realize that and do something about it before it becomes a really significant problem or a much more significant problem, or the world's going to take over. So my thinking is post-growth planning is not just an idea. It's something we need to actually do. And not only do we need to do it, but we are going to end up having to do it. So we might as well figure out how to do it now.
Thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts today, Sophie, with us. Many regards to Liverpool, and looking forward to seeing you again. Many thanks.
Thank you.